Hello, and welcome to Crit Club, the podcast where four friends watch movies from the Criterion Channel streaming service that none of them have seen before. I'm your host, Angela, and with me, as always, is Wizard Chris.
Oh, hello.
Corey.
Hello.
And Peter Allen Clark.
Peter Allen Clark here, reporting for duty. Film duty.
Film duty, everyone. Salute. This week, we're watching Joseph L. Mankiewicz's 1954 film, The Barefoot Contessa, starring Humphrey Bogart and Ava Gardner. Bogart stars as director Harry Dawes, a down-on-his-luck film director who is recently sober, having to work with millionaire producer Kirk Edwards, who just wants to own the world and dominate his workers according to his selfish whims. They, along with their intrepid public relations whiz Oscar Muldoon, played by Edmund O'Brien, are in search of the world's next big star, and they think it's Ava Gardner's Maria Vargas, a Spanish dancer in Madrid. This film is not officially in the Criterion Collection and does not have a spine number. I chose this film on a whim. It just felt right. Sometimes things just do. I was vaguely aware of the film, perhaps a little less aware of it than Ina Gardner's TV show of the same name, The Barefoot Contessa, and was curious whether it was something I might be missing. And from the first shot, I was sucked in. The film starts at Maria's funeral, not an auspicious beginning, but an intriguing one all the same. Crit Clubbers, you tell me, were you charmed by The Barefoot Contessa? I'm going to start with Corey. Corey, tell me, were you a fan of The Barefoot Contessa?
God, why are you calling on me first? I feel like...
No, because I know. How this is going to go, and I just want to get it out of the way.
I think that one half of this movie could have been completely eliminated. The other fourth of the movie, like one fourth of the movie, could have been like shown instead of told. And then like maybe you might start to be sculpting a like somewhat interesting movie. This was just so much telling and no showing and like just really weird stuff where it's like things would happen off screen and then you're just like, oh, here's this happening and like this is the outmath and like I don't know. It was just so weird in its construction where you almost felt like the director was looking away anytime that anything was actually happening and then he would just like go and have someone tell you what just happened. And it's like, well, have the people do the thing that you're talking about. And then, I don't know, just the scenes that were in there were just like stretching on for so long. I was just like, go to the next scene. Like, why are you doing this? And like, I don't know. I don't think any of the characters were really that interesting. And like the actual like conflict of the movie just, I don't know, fell flat with me. The just like rich guys trying to get richer by making this woman a star and she doesn't want it, so she just shouldn't do it. Like, I don't know, like why are you forcing her to do this thing that she obviously doesn't want to do? And then there were just like these little like, you know, little picadillos of weird things happening. Like, what was the whole thing with her father and like why did that happen? And like go back there, and then the ending just kind of like comes out of absolute nowhere. It's like you know that she's gonna die, but you don't know why. And then it's just like, oh, he's like a jealous guy and he shot her, and I guess he gets away with it. Maybe, I don't know. We'll talk about it. It was a very unsatisfying ending, especially because they try to hook you with that. Like, and they open in the funeral, and it's like there, it's like, oh, she's gonna die. And so, like, they're pushing her into this, like, you know, position, you know, that she doesn't want to do and she's resisting. It's like, that's an interesting kind of conflict. And like, but so like basically these guys are like, the setup is like basically these guys are going to result in her death. These guys are, you know, either directly or indirectly going to cause her death. And like, that doesn't end up being the case at all. It's just like this weird little thing that gets tacked on in the last 10 minutes of the movie that she gets shot with some other guy that we also never see. So I don't know, didn't like it, but I don't think that surprises anybody.
Thank you, Corey. I really, it's nice to hear your feedback on this because I was thinking you might like it a little bit more than a little bit more, only because I thought so much about it was about, in some ways, like class and sex struggles. And I found that part of it really fascinating. And I really liked how evil the rich guy was. And
An evil rich guy.
All the rich guys are very evil. That's true.
And I just thought you would find, you know, find that at least a little bit satisfying. But I actually kind of agree with you on a lot of your other points. But let's hear more from someone else. We don't know. Are they going to like the movie? Or are they not going to like the movie? I'm going to go maybe with Wizard.
Oh, I go next. Oh, Evil Rich Guy played a villain on a season 2 episode of Star Trek. It was very distracting. Other than that, maybe season 3. Anyways, look it up. Someone correct us in the comments.
TNG,
are we talking Next Generation?
TNG?
No, yeah. No, we're talking original series. Let's not do this.
High five, Angela.
But the Barefoot Contessa, to the point. Yeah, I don't know. It was okay. it was strictly okay. I really enjoyed some of the dialogue, especially in the earlier part of the film. Had that like sort of like snappy, like quick, kind of like mid-century American movie kind of writing that I sort of enjoy. I like that it's like, you know, again, mid-century American film, like this cast of like somewhat bitter, like weathered characters who are all sort of tossed together to ruin this this one like seemingly perfect woman's life. Yeah, it is very much a show don't tell movie. I think that in part that's
a tell don't show.
I think what the director is trying to do, what the writer and director is trying to do, is make a movie about Hollywood that's not about Hollywood.
So smart.
Sorry. So like the parts that we as like an audience of filmgoers would see, like the movies that she makes with Humphrey Bogart and the and like, you know, her life on stage and screen or whatever. All that stuff is kind of cut out, so that we can just follow her. I don't know what exactly. Like, I don't know if this is a movie about like a group of men destroying a woman, or if this is a movie about a woman who is like mildly unconventional, I guess. Maybe by the standards of 1954, but a woman who's like mildly unconventional, who is repeatedly punished and beaten down for being mildly unconventional for 1954. It's like a mixed bag, you know. There's some good stuff in here. I thought Ava Gardner and Humphrey Bogart were really good. Like, I thought they did a cool job with the material. I love seeing Bogart on screen, and he does a good job. But, you know, I was trying to figure out, you know, what is this movie like really about, or what am I supposed to really take away from it? And it's just kind of like a Hollywood tragedy, I guess. It's like a Sunset Boulevard, or I don't know, other movies set in Hollywood where sad things happen to people. Because Hollywood, Map to the Stars, I guess, by David Cronenberg. That's a good one. Like I said, I had fun with it. I had a good time, I had a good ride with it. I love how they talked about this count's impotence without once referring to sex at all. Very skillfully done. And yeah, I think there's a lot to sort of break down as we kind of move through the movie. But like overall, I was just like, yeah, this is okay. It's a fine time.
That's kind of how Frida was. I should have mentioned that. Like, she was like, yeah, it's all right.
Peter, what you thinking on this one?
Okay, yeah. So what was this movie about? Just saying it's a tragedy, like Sunset Boulevard was about something.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Like, that was very much about, you know, this faded glory, this lost life, aging, decay. And I kept thinking, like, what the fuck is this movie? Like, what is this movie even trying to say? What is it trying to be about as it floats from, you know, Hollywood producers to, you know, European rich people? And of course, there is like a class thing in there. Mm-hmm. But she keeps getting, you know, she keeps moving up the social ladder, and she keeps climbing up. If I want to be the kindest I can be to this movie about what it's trying to portray with its star, Barefoot Contessa, the kindest I can be is it saying, what did I write down? That she is an embodiment of mystical, unknowable feminine energy. The least kindest I could say, which I think is how I took this movie, is this is a movie about men telling this woman's story. I'm actually getting mad now thinking about
it's
it.
True.
This is a movie about men telling this woman's story and not even telling her story through her actions. It's telling her story through actions of the men around her as they affect her. Like, oh, I didn't know I was mad about this movie. This really, like, as I started, I was like, oh shit, I'm actually mad about this. Like, any sort of agency is taken away from her. Like, this is not her story. This is like far below the manic pixie dream girl that everybody wants to. Like, no, this is like these wistful men like talking about her life and everything. But they're not like, and it's bad enough that they are the ones telling her story. They really are telling her story through the actions of other men around her. Like, not her decisions, not what she wants, not her goals, not anything that she's striving for or interested in, not what actually makes her comfortable. Like, she wants to feel safe and protected. Like, what does make her feel safe and protected? Like, it doesn't even, there's no internal exploration at all about the title character. And that sucks. And I really hold that against this movie. And then also, I don't like how it tells this story. Like, it is, Corey and Wizard both said it, like, it is so tell, don't show. It keeps talking about how the rich tycoon wants to make a movie is a terrible guy. And yeah, they do show him slapping a woman. But like, there's so much about like, I know you're gonna, I've seen you, you know, tear women's lives up. Like, what? They're telling us over and over and over again about all this sort of stuff. They're telling us about how bad this mother is. They're telling us about how popular a star she becomes. Mm-hmm. Like, nothing is shown. Nothing is shown about actually the things that have happened. And then they need an ending. They need some sort of twist, some sort of strategy. And so, I'm sorry, let me finish this real rant. I'm almost done. And so this woman who has been, what we fucking know about this poor woman whose story life has been taught to us, what we know is that she is dedicated to her morals. She's dedicated to herself and dedicated to her morals and unmoving about what she wants to do. And so it seems like she's just been a chaste person who hasn't found it within herself to like give herself to, like, that's how I took it. Like, she, like, it's never shown her to be like a particularly sexual being.
She was like, in a curtain,
the curtain thing was like
with her
what about
cousin.
With her cousin? Her cousin.
She couldn't, oh, I missed that completely. I watched that twice.
At the end,
okay.
She talks about how she couldn't go like a week with her impotent husband without like finding some other guy.
That's what I'm saying. Is all this movie wanted? All this movie wanted to show to me. I missed the cousin thing. Gotcha. Is that like she's a person beholden to herself, and then it seems like she didn't go a week. Somehow temptation struck her, and she is no longer in control of her own life, and messes this up because it seemed like the movie needed a shocking, dramatic ending.
It was a bit of a heel turn for her in the last like 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. I did find that I was like, I don't recognize this character at all. And like, I don't know anything about you, but I don't think this makes any sense.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Like, I've ranted a lot. Like, there are positive things I have to say about it. I do think it was beautifully shot. I really enjoyed seeing these different vistas, and I think like the lighting was actually really lovely, and some of the coloring was stunning, honestly.
Her costumes are great.
But yeah, I really like, this isn't even an of the time thing. That sucks. That fucking sucks. So all right.
But before we get to you, Angela, can I just say my favorite instance of the telling and not showing was at the courtroom, where she's standing there in the courtroom talking. And the guy's like
her
saying,
monologue,
she had a great, you know, argument that really swayed everyone. I'm like, she's standing right there. She's talking right now. You could literally show us this rather than telling us about it. It was so bizarre.
I really want to hear what you thought, Angela. I really want to discuss this movie. What did you think of Barefoot Contessa?
Well, I liked it. I liked it, but you're right. All of you are right. Like, it is all mostly telling, not showing. It's ironically, though, the film did win a Best Screenplay award for Joseph L. Mankiewicz, which is just
nominated. I'm seeing.
I thought he won.
Which, yeah, says it was nominated for
Slow Year.
Maybe.
Yeah, the O'Brien guy, the sweaty guy, won for Best Supporting Actor.
Yeah.
So there's that, but you know, I actually didn't mind because this was the reality of the time in terms of a bunch of men telling what they think is the woman's story, right? Like, how many female directors were there even in 1950? Like, I don't even know. Probably not that many. How many female screenwriters were there? Probably not that many. What I enjoyed was I felt like I was seeing a female character who was independent and doing things on her own terms as much as she could, even if in many of those cases she was just like, I'm just going to do the opposite of the thing that you want me to do. And I think we all know people who will kind of decide to do something that might not actually be in their best interest just to be contrary. And I found watching the results of those choices to be compelling, to keep me through up until the point where the count comes in. I found everything after the count to be just ridiculous. Like, I couldn't, yeah. None of that made sense. One of the most interesting parts to me, though, of that whole situation is that they had two different tellings of the part where she gets slapped by the South American business guy.
And we had mentioned Rashomon in the group chat. Yeah.
And in one version, she slaps him. And in another version, he slaps her. And it's just really fat. The part where I get the most fascinating is trying to understand what is the filmmaker trying to say by including both of those versions. I think for me, that's the key to this film. Yeah, there's all kinds of things wrong with it, but I still loved that it used a lot of natural lighting. Like, I don't think I've seen, like, an in-color film from the 1950s that actually had, like, an outdoor daylit shot. At least one that I can't recall. Like, and so
Johnny Guitar did.
I don't. There's just something about the way that shot that seemed unusual to me. Like the whole funeral shot. I found the funeral scene to be the first one hugely compelling. I'm like, I am in. I want to know why. How did we get here? What the heck is going on? The nightclub scene was super interesting to me because the way that it was shot reminded me of John Singer Sargent did a whole bunch of paintings of Spanish dancers. And I swear to God, go look at some of those paintings and you almost have like the same color palette and lighting scheme. And I just found that to be really interesting as well. I liked how the filmmaker kind of found a way to get around the millionaire's machinations in terms of setting up these people to be beholden to him, which they did show, right? They talked about it, but essentially, like, you know, Harry Dawes wanted to quit the film. He's like, I could get out of here. But the millionaire's like, you'll never work again in this town. And so he made sure with the other filmmakers there that the same thing wouldn't happen to Maria Vargas. But I liked this film. I think there are things to talk about. I just enjoyed the costumes, the music, the way it was shot. I thought the PR position, I work in marketing, I fucking thought that was stupid and silly and loved watching that character just doing all the dumb things all the time. To promote whoever.
Sweaty PR guy.
So great.
It's like a thing in like screenwriting. It's a limp and an eye patch. So it's like you got to give your characters like these distinctive characteristics so that they'll stick out in people's mind. And like for this guy, it was just that he was a sweaty guy.
Moist.
And
moist
I think
PR.
Actually he was the best actor in this. And I'm not sure actually that Ava Gardner was that great. She felt really wooden.
She didn't have a character to be.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, I think
everyone.
Yeah.
And even Bogart was quoted as saying that he did not like working with her because she didn't give him much to play with. And I could see that in her character. But I feel like all the choices she was making were actually right for the character. But
I agree.
I haven't seen a lot of Bogart films, but like he's such a part of like, you know, pop culture or whatever. Yeah. And so you hear his voice and you see that opening like cinematic in the funeral. And it's like, this is a film noir movie. I mean, that's what they're like. I mean, because you can't have Humphrey Bogart's voice without thinking film noir and like just the starting, you know, at the ending.
Starting
at
a funeral in a rain in Italy. Yeah.
It's like there's going to be some like mystery or, you know, hard boiled edge to this or whatever. And there's just like, there's not really any mystery or whatever. So I don't know. That was the first bit of sort of mystery.
The mystery was, how did she die?
Did anyone entertain any ideas that that she would fake her own death and reappear at the end of the movie?
Yes. I was so hoping. I was so
amazing.
I was so hoping, and I was like, please let her have some agency and freedom. That would have been freedom. That would have felt like her finding freedom.
That would have been a much better ending.
That would have been all right, yeah. She gets to do the barefoot thing in some rural village or something, but it's not that kind of movie. Because she goes crazy in the last 20 minutes and cheats on her count husband, whom
and
she
you
loves.
You all say impotent, like, but the way that he said that, it sounded like his dick got blown off.
Well, yes, yeah.
But he didn't tell her until after they
exactly.
got married. That's fucked up. That's
not consent. It's so fucked up.
Right?
It's so fucked up.
If it was me, I would have totally. I've been like, oh, fuck this shit. This shit.
At like that. That was like, my notes say, "Oh God damn it."
He passes her. He passes her a doctor's note that says, "Sorry, I can't fuck you," which was not a compelling scene. Like,
no.
But again, 1954. Like, they're trying to explain why they can't have sex, and they can't say the word sex. So here we go.
You know, it's funny. They also made a film version of The Sun Also Rises in 1957. So just a few years later, story about it. Guys had his junk blown off.
Oh God, I don't know. I have so much I want to say. Where should we even start?
Let's start at the beginning.
Well, starting at the beginning, you know, we have the
where
funeral.
we're not seeing Ava Gardner dance, but we're
which I love. Can I tell you?
I know. I liked it too.
I deeply loved that.
I actually liked it deeply.
That was like the first because that did, and it stood in such stark contrast to what didn't happen throughout the rest of the film. Was it showed instead of told? Like it did that thing where there's no way we're going to be able to show her dancing as amazingly as we want to, and let's show all these emotions that her dancing is arising in people. I was even more than the funeral. I thought the funeral was like interesting, but that whole dancing scene, I was like, oh, this is incredible. I was really in this movie because I thought that was masterful how that was structured.
Yeah, I liked that too. Going from person to person and seeing their different reactions and all that stuff. I thought that was
Even whether it had, I don't know. It was gorgeous. I thought that was the best part of this movie.
Yeah, and also just because of like, you know, sometimes, you know, creative limitations, putting yourself into a creative box can actually have you come up with more interesting solutions and stuff. So I don't know much about Ava Gardner. Maybe she's not a good dancer, but then that box of not being able to have her dance like makes you have these other interesting creative choices of instead of going around and showing what the people are reacting. And like at the end of the day, like how she makes other people feel is kind of what's more important here for this story. It's, you know, still be showing that she is a sensation.
That's smart.
She is, you know, doing that. So yeah, I liked that opening scene.
Oh, go ahead, Angel.
Oh, no, go ahead. That opening scene, watching everybody, like, there was a person knitting. You know me, I knit during a lot of these recordings. So, I felt like parts of this movie were, like, directed specifically at me in terms of, like, wow, I'm watching this now. Because even, like, Humphrey Bogart's character at the beginning in this nightclub scene was talking about, I'll be 5 months alcohol free next Tuesday. And I'm like, actually, next Tuesday, I will be 5 months alcohol free. So I was like, oh, thanks, universe.
So I don't know when to talk about this, but like him starting drinking again, I also didn't feel like had a great conclusion. Like, did I miss something? Or is it just that like at that last scene at the end of the movie where she comes and visits him, he's just like drinking again? And
I guess we're just, right. I didn't even notice that.
I mean, he had a whole little bar set up there, and he was just drinking again, but like...
I mean, I would go so far as to say the Humphrey Bogart character is almost as thin as the Barefoot Contessa character. Mm-hmm. Like, good guy. Yeah. Like, you know, that's all you can... Good guy.
They're friends.
And he gets mad at her at the end in a way, I don't know.
But actually, I have to say, like, seeing an actual friend that at no point Humphrey Bogart was really, like, actively
I did
chasing
like
her
that.
As
yeah,
romantic.
I was
that
worried
was
about
hugely
that.
Sad. Yeah. And on top of that, I loved seeing his actual partner, Jerry, who does not resemble a man. I found that really satisfying.
Yeah, they're just, like, they're congenial with each other, and that's cool. There's no weirdness between Bogart and Ava Gardner or Jerry. That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're just these platonic colleagues throughout.
And I want to get this out of the way. This is my version, I think, of Corey's opening credits thing. and I've brought it up
he
a couple times. The last,
movie.
I think, time. I think I brought it up in Johnny Guitar, but also in when we watched Farewell, My Lovely. I have such a big problem with these older men who are like styled as like debonair And Humphrey Bogart looks like he's going to die, and he does 2 years later. And I was like, okay. This, I felt I couldn't watch him without thinking, this is a sick man. This is an unwell man who is trying to, who like has a broken broomstick off his back shirt to keep him sitting straight up in this chair. And I just have a big problem with with the 50s and 60s specifically about these older gold, like golden age of Hollywood men who are just put in positions that I don't think they belong.
Yeah.
That seems absolutely fair. So what happens next? We have like the whole, she does a screen test. I don't think we even see the screen test, right?
No.
Nope.
So,
which is fine.
I guess that's okay. But like, no, before that we get like, you know, her saying no. It's like,
oh, yeah.
You know, lot. It's like,
and that was a long conversation.
Yeah. It was like, hey, you're going to go back there and talk to her. And like, then one guy goes and she said no. And then they have to send another guy in and he has to basically trick her in order to like, it's just like, man, why? I don't know.
And then he goes finds her at her house, and that's where you get, the conversation about her hating shoes,
right.
Mm-hmm. which like that conversation was so long that I wrote in my notes that it just went around in circles. It seemed to me, because at one point in time, I wrote all this down that she says, she hates shoes because, she's. Oh, yeah. She hates shoes because she likes feeling comfortable and safe in the dirt. But also she straight up says she's afraid of being exposed and unprotected. And I was just like, those are two competing thoughts to me.
No, but you
I
see,
don't know. Like,
she's protected by her friends, the hookworms.
Yes, I see.
My note for this scene, my note is groan. Just end this scene.
It was a very long scene. They kept talking. And I really feel like that it went around in circles.
Yeah.
But it was nice, I don't know, to a point. I
liked the lighting. The lighting was gorgeous, and that whole talk
really
about
pretty.
The key lighting, you know, and exactly what that is, and how in that moment they are actually showing what they're telling.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. I agree with that.
But it also,
there's so much about this. Oh, go ahead.
No. There's so much. Keep going.
Well, I'm really curious about your all's thoughts about this movie being a commentary on Hollywood itself, right? I mean, Humphrey Bogart talks about, this is not the first producer who's done all this, and the waste and the like debauchery and like the den of sin that Hollywood is. And she goes there, and I don't know. I'm curious about, because that's the next stop on this, is she, I guess, goes and finds stardom, but to what end? And what does that? I don't know. What's this movie about?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
It's about how rich people are miserable. In a lot of ways, that's really the only like cohesive theme that I can kind of cobble together is the wealthy are miserable. And
they get their dicks blown off.
Yeah.
And they get, well, that's, yeah, that's part of it.
We have like the business class, the political class, and then we have the royalty. What do we call that usually?
The aristocracy.
That's the one.
You're right. And that is the solid theme, right? I mean, like that is the that separates her from her background, and then it shows up again whenever she meets the count when she's dancing with those, I guess they were Roma. I guess that's what it says.
Yeah, like and she's like, these are my people, kind of like, I'm gonna go and dance with the people. And in that case, you know, earlier in the film, we don't actually see her dancing, right? But we do see her dancing when she is among like regular, normal, everyday people.
And it pops up again at the end with their wedding when she wants to dance with the help or whatever, the servants out in the yard. Yeah, I think that's a solid through line with this. But I'm not sure why it needs to go to three different places or have three different sort of structured themes around this. I don't know. Whatever. I don't want to
imagine.
She goes to Hollywood.
Well, I imagine like dancing is her natural state, right? She is billed originally as a dancer. And so for me, the juxtaposition of all these things are kind of like the extent to which these structures of society prevent human beings from actually being able to be their true selves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I buy that.
So this movie is kind of the cinematic equivalent of that poorly drawn meme of the person at the party standing in the corner with the drink, being like, "They don't know I'm X, Y, Z." It's like, no, we know.
Yeah.
They don't know I'm not wearing shoes.
Yeah, I guess rich people are miserable is what you can take away from that, which is something, you know, I'll promote that. And like, you know, the happiness of the count and the miserable awfulness of the villain from season two of Star Trek juxtaposed with this, like, I really enjoyed the South American playboy character. Mm-hmm. I love like a cheerfully amoral character. if not necessarily in my life, but in fiction, mm-hmm. I love someone who is cheerfully like, I'm a bastard and I'm good with that. I appreciate the honesty, I guess. And I enjoyed their like shouting match at the party, even though it also, like many things in this movie, just kind of petered out at a certain point. And the season two villain of Star Trek is like, well, I love America, and the guy's like, whatever, I love wherever I'm from, and I love tax sheltering in America. I'm just like, okay, somebody say cut.
Before we get there, though, before we get to that scene of the party, I do want to, Corey brought it up, and I couldn't agree more about this courtroom, about this whole scene of her mom dying. Like, I reread the...
Or no, her father dying. It was her father.
No, her father killed her mom.
Her father murders her mother.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, I reread the plot synopsis on Wikipedia right before we started recording just to make sure I didn't miss anything, because I felt I did.
Yeah.
And it doesn't even mention it in there. Like, this is like... It doesn't even... Yeah. What does it say? I've got it up
right
here.
Random weird throwaway...
It says, Maria is a blithe but pride spirit who goes barefoot and has a troubled home life, and that is the only thing that is mentioned of this, like... 10 minutes of like, or like 7 to 10 minutes of screen time about like them getting the call that her mother died, but it was her father who killed her, and now she's got to go into court. And what's this going to do? And it's like, what the fuck is
going to damage her career? Absolute,
but it, then it doesn't, though. But it has no stakes. There's no consequences for any of that.
The consequence that the movie states is that now she's an even bigger star for breaking the rules, because she like had to go deal with a family situation, like when she was like having such a big star. And then this is also a part where like the other guy starts voiceovering, like he's the one who says that.
Yeah.
I was
Rashomon,
so
baby.
Confused.
Yeah.
And I was like, I said to Freedom, like, I think, I don't know what, I was like, what's going on? Who's talking here? And so Freedom was able to tell, but like, I know Humphrey Bogart has like one of the most like iconic and, you know, sort of, you know, easily recognizable voices in the world. But like, I couldn't tell those two guys apart, and I couldn't, I didn't even realize for the first like 5-10 minutes that there was now all of a sudden two narrators like happening here. And I'm just like, what is going on? It was so poorly done. And I just want to give a plug for like one of my favorite movies, Election, which has 4 narrators, and it is always crystal clear who is narrating in every scene, and they do it so well.
And I want to give a plug for my thinking that narration is always lazy screenwriting.
It often is.
Well, I guess it,
But wait, but that like, so there's that party where they stand up to him, and I honestly, the reason I reread the plot synopsis was because I didn't understand why sweaty PR guy stood up to the rich man, and I was like, I did watch that scene twice, and then I was like, I'm still not understanding like why. Sure, he can say there that he got tired of being his lackey, but there was no hint of that in anything that showed before this, and then that just happens.
Yeah, there's no setup for that.
I don't know. I felt like it. Like this guy is a ball buster, and anybody who is going to work with that guy is going to get sick of working with him, right? And so when
but
he's
did you
talking,
pick up on that before he said that?
I did. Yeah, I mean, I've worked in the industry and I've worked with a lot of assholes. That shit ain't sustainable, right? So he talks to the barefoot Contessa. He talks to Maria and is like, hey, I'm going to go take this other job. Or who is he talking to? I forget who he's talking to, but I'm trying to work with. Yeah. Mm. And so he's ostensibly taking that job and then, you know, sticks it to Mr. Big American Bucks.
Yeah, you're right, though. That conversation about America.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It could have been better. Yeah, this all could have been better, just like America. It could have been better.
That's an interesting perspective. I like that.
This party scene is also where they're like, I think it's Humphrey Bogart. Basically, it says like, you know, you have all these things or whatever. And now what you need is like a man or whatever.
Like, oh my God.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I mean, that brings me to like the, I'm not this later on in the movie, but it is one of my chief, I think the whole theme to me of this movie is what Humphrey Bogart says to like the Count on their wedding night when he says emotionally she's a child. Mm-hmm. Like this, yeah, I don't know. This
I
movie has no
respect. Like,
I definitely disagreed with that because that's a terrible thing to say about somebody who's supposed to be your friend.
But it's also like his perception, which is the entirety of this movie, is men's perception of her.
Yeah, she doesn't want to do what the men want her to do. Therefore, she's acting like a child. And I thought she was just acting like a child.
Never mind
that. Not wanting to be Fallout Boy. That's what I kept thinking of.
Never mind that she speeched her father out of a murder charge and is obviously the most sensible human in the entire film.
Through what we're told is a very stirring and moving speech.
Indeed. It looked stirring, but then again, it didn't.
So
anyways.
Around here, I mean, she just like lays into this guy and punches him and stuff like on the boat. But like, can we talk about just like the slapping in this movie?
Oh my God. This is a slap happy movie.
Wow.
Very slap happy.
Very slap happy.
I audibly, first slap, I went, whoa. I was watching it with headphones. And Laura came in and she was like, what happened? And I'm like, oh, it's a movie from the 50s. A man just slapped a woman.
Blaspheming Jesus or whatever.
Oh!
And she was like, oh, okay.
That's one of the reasons why I also found that rich man compelling, because it sort of represented that whole, like, American, I'm religious, you better like your mother kind of bullshit. And, of course, he slaps a woman. So, you know, all of that
is really
fucking bullshit. It's not real. There is no sanctity. It's used as a tool to control people according to his whims.
But then, like, this pivotal scene... So okay, I'm going to try to remember the course of events of, like...
Talking about the casino?
Well, no, we're
oh, okay.
Where it's, like, she gets slapped, and then the other guy gets slapped, and then, like, and then she just, like... she just takes his hand. This is when she meets the Count, I guess, and then the Count just, like,
takes her... Yeah, this is the casino.
That's in the casino. Oh, okay, all right.
Which again, I think, why did the guy get mad? Like, why did the South American rich guy get mad? Because she walked away?
Oh, yeah, she was trying to stand up and he, like, pushed her down. He was accusing her of taking money. I don't think she took
money.
She took
money.
She did?
She did take money?
Yeah,
he accused her.
Okay, no, because there's two different stories that are told, right? Or we have it from the perspective of the Count. We have it from the perspective of, I think, the PR guy. And at some point... Maria is standing behind the South American guy who's gambling, and she takes like a bunch of money or one of the chips and cashes it in and gives the money, actually sneaks it to one of the gypsies or the Romani.
I missed this.
Oh no, it was totally there.
Okay.
And then the South American business guy, he had been on a streak, but once she took the money, that streak ended and he flipped out and came in and he was basically mad because ostensibly she hasn't been having sex with him, which means that she's incapable of love. Not that he's an asshole, you know, as these things go, apparently. And then he slaps her because, you know, women apparently owe men everything.
But it was because his streak was broken, or that's what the excuse he gave.
But he said that she was a thief, then also said she was a monster incapable of love.
Yeah.
And
yikes.
This is, and you see why I pictured her as like a chaste person who then all of a sudden becomes like, you know, sleeping around in the last 10 minutes.
But it's out of love, or so we're supposed to believe.
But she's behind the curtains with the guy who we're assuming she's sleeping with. But then there's this thing where it's like they're at the party. We're going back in time a little bit, but they're in the party. And then there's that house in the backyard. And they're sort of like, he's sort of hinting that she has a lover living over there.
Yeah, I was curious about that too.
Right?
Is that what that was going on?
Yeah.
Because wait, the cousin from the very beginning, wasn't the cousin also at her home whenever Humphrey Bogart went back there?
No.
I don't think so.
I don't think that was it was another guy. I mean, it was her brother or something. Boy, okay. All right. Thanks, Angela. That actually helps me because I was curious about what was Humphrey Bogart angry about that house behind her house. Because there was just like some music starting.
I think somebody was living there. I don't think it was the cousin, though.
It was some guy. It was a lover because at the end of that scene, her shoes are left outside in the backyard and she goes to the house. That's the intonation there. However, here's the thing. Like what Humphrey Bogart's character was upset about was that you have all these rich guys who are vying for Maria and they don't really know that she actually has someone already that. And so she's kind of playing them all, which, you know, in this world, I would say, why the hell not? But we all know why the hell not by the end of this movie, because doing shit like that in that day and age could get you killed. And actually, it's just not good to have poor communication anyway. But no, this movie, it wasn't necessarily like super clear with the way, because they weren't showing, they were kind of doing this whole thing where not everything is what it appears to be. So I don't know. I don't know if I'm
That's helpful. I'm glad to hear you say that because it's helpful to know that stuff.
Yeah, the movie starts to Rashomon on us and it doesn't really explain that's the conceit of it, I guess, which, you know, I don't need the movie to say this is what we're doing now necessarily, but that's like story told from two different perspectives is a film or a cinematic device that works really, really well and is really interesting, but you have to like signal at some point that this is what you're doing or this is what this movie is going to be doing. I don't know.
Should we move to talk about, you know, as we're ending, getting towards the ending of this film, where she marries the count in a Catholic ceremony that I have not seen a Catholic ceremony depicted in that way. It kind of reminded me of...
He's Italian.
Yeah.
So Humphrey Bogart gives her away, quote unquote, but like her father's alive. She went to Italy to save her father from going to jail. Why doesn't her father come to
Spain?
Or Spain, sorry. Maybe
he did go to jail. He just didn't get hung, you know, or shot or whatever.
I thought she saved him.
Like, he did strangle his wife to death. I'm sure there's some jail time involved.
I don't know. Self-defense.
Not under the
generalissimo. I thought the whole point was her going to save him from jail. And so then, like, why is he getting the snub for being in her wedding? I don't know.
There was also discussion, like, the dude doesn't seem to know where he is. Like, he's just not competent enough to dad at this point. He's a murderer.
People put rings on dogs and have them walk down the aisle. They don't know where they are either. But.
Well, not in 1950s Italy, they don't. I'll tell you that.
Well, I mean, did you hear that guy talk about the international set where in Cannes there is a groomer,
I love that.
A hairstylist just for dogs? Oh,
what a morally bankrupt society that must be.
Yeah. Wait, before we get away from
I
want to say
strip mall by my house, like what
they had this list of names of all of this international set, and I did write down Lulu McGee.
I did remember Lulu McGee. Good name.
Well, and
good NPC.
That was some really good skewering of the royal family at that time. Actually, like that was a not too thinly veiled reference to Wallace Simpson and the original future king of Europe. And I forget, was he a George? Was he a Henry? He's the one who was exiled to France, and the one who was working with the Nazis.
Edward the Eighth.
Is that the one?
Edward the Eighth. Yeah,
you're the one in
the Nazi sympathizer. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I remember all of our kings dating back to the time of Alfred the Great.
What a good servant of the royal of the monarchy.
Hear, hear. Yeah.
But I found that immensely, like, that was on the part of the writer. That was like, hey, let's shit on, you know, the international set. Because we all imagine that these things, like these rich people, are fascinating and create a sense of safety, but actually they're kind of boring and mundane and gross.
I did enjoy, that dig at like, oh, this is the pretender to some European throne, but all he really does is like play pinochle or whatever. And gets, you know, even aristocracy gets boring. which again, rich people are unhappy, which is a great a great theme for a film that we could have explored in a little more detail, maybe.
Oh, sorry. Wait, I wanted to ask. So what did you all think about that conversation? Because it was another long conversation that I was like, that I thought was a little tantalizing, but I was curious about your all thought between, I'm sorry, is it his sister? Is it the Count's sister?
I think that was a weird scene.
Yeah, it was a strange scene, but it did like portend. There was I've thought about every man, woman, and child since November 20th, 1942. It, like, it's like very much hinting that there is some sort of dark thing that happened then. But it also felt like overly sad boy.
Yeah,
I think about every man, woman, and child.
There was going to be some like, you know, Jamie Lannister type stuff going on.
I was expecting like, some rich person incest.
Yeah. That's kind of weird hugging, guys.
Maybe that's an unfortunate byproduct,
this is the royalty we're talking about. They're all in
that. You know what? That's a good point. That's a good point.
Yeah, but I thought that was an interesting scene that did portend. It did like, there's not everything as well with this Count.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like that's an interesting character beat. Like he's the last of his line. Like he's a man who was injured in war doing the thing that he's supposed to do, and now his line is gonna die. And like I don't give a shit, but like I understand why that's important to aristocracies, to the dying rich, you know.
And his sister's like, don't marry her because she'll break her heart. But there's so much of it was, but also you could have just told her before.
You could have just told her. Like if you're like, why is he dragging this woman down with him? And like, you know, if your genitals got blown off in a war or something like that, you're not a weight around anybody's neck. But if you lie to somebody about like, your ability to like start a family with them and you're like, oh, I love you, but I won't tell you that I can't like make love to you. Like there's no indication at all that this character is like that. And it's another weird like heel turn in a movie filled with heel turns that make no sense.
But also like,
I agree.
P and the V sex is not the end all be all
exactly.
of sex. It's your wedding day. Fool around.
Yeah.
All he wants
make
is
out
heir,
on that big elaborate like, bed back there. Like
no, we got paperwork to talk about.
Very serious paperwork. We got a tour group coming through here. It's the only way to keep the coffers full. So we got to get out of this room.
As I do with most of the movies we watch, I looked at my huge Pauline Kael 5001 Nights at the Movie book that I have that I'm holding up right here.
She hated it.
I love Pauline Kael. She does incredible jobs. But I was fascinated by this line that she says, where she says, the movie is so ornate and so garrulous about telling the dirty truth that it's a camp classic, a Cinderella story in which the prince turns out to be impotent. And I thought that was like a very interesting perspective to view this movie.
That is interesting. That is an interesting take on that.
I wonder if I would have had more fun with this movie if I was looking at it if it was campy.
Yeah. I mean, like, I thought about that because when the reveal happens, when the dick blown off reveal happens, I was like, I wish I was watching this with people because we would have all burst out laughing.
Yeah.
Huh.
Shocking. Shocking reveal on your wedding night.
That's the worst.
Wow.
Yeah, and then I guess he's just a murderer too, you know?
Yeah, like, I guess like, it's not,
you know.
And then Humphrey Bogart's like, I'm just going to hang out.
Yeah. We got to go to work in the morning.
Why is the climax of this movie? Dead. Yeah, why is the climax of this movie so boring? Like she's dead, and he just like just slumps across the room, and then just sits down, and then they talk some more, and it's like, jeez, man.
Well, and then at the funeral, like, what is this guy even doing allowed to be at the funeral? He caused the funeral, and then the cops walk him away.
Pretty sure you can't show up to your murder victim's funeral. I feel like that's frowned upon, even in the very liberal country of Italy, which is not that liberal.
No.
So those were cops. When I guess we're supposed to assume that there was some sort of justice here, or
Because he gets taken away.
Yeah.
Like at the end of like that scene when Humphrey Bogart's there, like the police show up and he gets taken away by the police.
Some working class people touch him. That's punishment enough for the aristocracy.
Oh no! This whole movie is basically women pay the price for men's masculinity
yes.
whenever it is threatened.
Yes, 100%.
But that moral is told to us by men.
who don't seem aware of it themselves.
Yeah. Wait a second. I want to talk about my second favorite part, my actual earnestly favorite part about this movie that I thought was kind of suddenly brilliant. So after the big reveal of my dork gone, like he walks out and like there's this swell of like laughter from the servants down in the courtyard that like felt maliciously like dark in this way of like not only are they laughing because they're having a good time, but it to me at least, and I'm curious if you all have felt the same way, it felt like they were laughing at her like this was a joke on it. Like I felt that was like
that was intentional.
Really was dark and crazy. I thought that was exceptional.
Yeah, that was quite because I thought that was coming from something else on my computer. I was like, where's that terrifying laughter coming from? But no, it was the movie reminding us that this is a pretty bad day for her.
Well, and that she's essentially been deceived.
Oh, yeah.
And that she wasn't the only, you know, she was the only one really who didn't know. That was how I took it.
Because her sister knew.
Maybe,
sister.
Bogart didn't know because he doesn't concern himself with the contents of another man's pants. He's smoking. Just smoking and smoking.
I want to return before we kind of end this and get to like rolling. We talk a lot, and I think it's a great conversation that we have had throughout our 50 some odd episodes around how to watch movies of another era and on what to sort of like give leeway. Like I feel pretty passionate that these men telling this women's story is not, that's still not okay with me. Like that's like, I don't give this movie a pass because it was, you know, 60 years ago. I think that's still shitty storytelling in any era. And I don't think it's like more awareness that women have internal lives that deserve exploration. I think it's like was actively a choice for these three men to tell this woman's story. And I don't think that in any era that I personally find that to be, okay storytelling. I don't know.
I don't give it a pass, but I'm like just accepting the time as it was. And what does that actually mean from a criticism standpoint? And
I mean, I feel like we've watched movies that like from this era that have told women stories that give them agency and internal lives, you know? Like, I mean, Johnny Guitar, as much as I'll complain about Johnny Guitar, Johnny Guitar had women with agency and internal lives.
Yeah, they were the protagonists. They were the antagonists. Like,
I just feel like that the point of the film would have been compromised by actually giving that person agency. I think that it's almost a caricature of a woman's experience. And I wouldn't actually expect, especially since there was so much emphasis on the male. Like, I mean, this was a male movie in all actuality. I'm not saying that it's right. I'm just saying maybe this was a creative choice that was intentional.
Well, I mean, and I'm sure it was. Like, it's funny because the pass, not that I'm giving any of this a pass, but like the nod that I'll give to this being from 1954 is the thing about waiting until they're married to reveal this thing. Like, to me, that did seem like a product of a time where I was like, yeah, that seems culturally, you know, that's fucked up. That's incredibly fucked up. But that also seems culturally keeping with that time. And I understand why that's in this movie. Like, I think to me, that's different of like telling this woman's story in this way. Like, sure, that was the way the most things were done culturally, but I still,
It's more of a comment on the fantasy that people have about being discovered as a movie star, right? Like a lot of women had fantasies about, oh, wouldn't it be amazing to be picked from the streets? Like this is actually, like they reference Cinderella a lot in this. This is meant to be a criticism of a fairy tale, right? And so like maybe-
But it comes off as criticism of a woman.
That too. I don't know. Yeah. I didn't actually feel, criticism of this particular woman. I get criticism of an industry, of a society that actually lacks dignity for regular working people, and that you have to have these stupid dreams to even imagine having a life of safety. But I don't know. I just think it's crappy that we don't get to see the wholeness of this woman, but how much of a whole woman can you get in that particular paradigm?
I don't know why I'm so incensed about this movie, but I deeply think it's fucked up. Like, the only people who suffer any consequences in this movie are women. Mm-hmm. Both the Barefoot Contessa and her mother. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah. And the two woman people who suffer at the beginning.
Yeah. The people who suffer any consequences or feel real life in any real way are these women. And I think that's...
It seems to me like there have been times where women were the ones having the consequences for male actions for quite a while. So it didn't seem out of place for me.
No, I mean, no. And of course, it's nothing new. I'm not saying anything that I just discovered or whatever. Yeah. But I also don't have to have patience for it. Yeah. You know, and like, this is a movie about men's sadness over how women keep having to face the consequences. And I don't fucking care. And I don't want it in my face. Yeah.
Or it's like it's like a movie that, like, especially near the end, it becomes very critical of, like, the sort of fantasy, like the Cinderella aspect. Like, they keep referring to her as Cinderella, and you know, her life is like a fairy tale. Like, she gets discovered dancing in a cafe in Spain. She didn't do anything to lean into that, like, fantasy aspect at all. Like, she's like, I don't really want to go to Hollywood, and like, she's like an unconventional movie star. Like, she doesn't seem to be like at no point does the movie project like, oh, she's swept up in the glitz and glamour and fantasy of being a movie star. She's like a woman, like, trying to find, like, a bit of happiness for herself. And so I guess that's the fantasy that these men are talking about, is the idea that this woman could enjoy a bit of happiness.
Because they're constantly, like, saying, like, why aren't you doing this? And why aren't you doing this? Like, these, you know, these other starlets do. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it just seems confusing that then we're supposed to believe by the end of the film, like, oh, she got all swept up in the fantasy of meeting her prince and blah 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 blah. And I'm like, no, like she met someone who she, like, loved, who lied to her, like, on a very, like, deep, like, deeply personal level, and then it falls apart in the last 20 minutes where she's like, well, I guess I'm just crazy now. I guess I'm just a crazy, like, Shakespearean, like, person who's like, oh, I've got the perfect solution to the problem. I'm just going to get pregnant and tell him that it's his. Brilliant. So good.
They need an
so
ending.
So smart and brave. And that, like, that upset me. I was like, what?
Yeah.
Did you not read the doctor's note? Like...
The paperwork.
I don't know. That signals to me that the movie is confused about what kind of story it's trying to tell. It wants to tell a story about, like, fantasies, but also about, like, how rich people are shitty. And it does one of those pretty well, because it's not hard to show how shitty the rich are. But it does this woman's search for happiness story so, like, slapdash and again through the lens of people who are, you know, arguably not that great to her. Like, I don't know, Bogart's all right. He doesn't, like, try to grab her at any point during the movie, which I respect, although he does grab her a bunch. It's in more of a paternal way because he's old and dying.
You know what this
I don't know. I don't know what to make of this.
I'm going to say one more positive thing about this movie. Does anybody else watch Succession?
Yeah.
No.
Yes, but I think there's a season. I haven't finished the last season.
Oh, it's fine. Yeah. This movie, like, had a lot of, like, I really enjoyed the on-location shooting and the Succession-ish of this shooting of, like, on a yacht. Mm-hmm. In Cannes, in the, you know, Italian countryside. I don't know. It did feel like grandiose in a lush, like, satisfying way.
Look where we're filming now.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Before we wrap up, I just want to go back to one random little thing. There's some throwaway line that Humphrey Bogart says of something, like, talking to Maria, is like, hey, you got it, and you can only, you either got it or you catch it from a public drinking cup. And I was like, what the hell is a public drinking cup?
You didn't know about public drinking cups? I mean, that was...
No, and I have a background in public health, too. I should know this.
Until 1918, during the Spanish flu. Like, every town had a cup for water.
Yeah, or a ladle. Cholera, they would just baby. Ladle, and they would just all drink out of the same ladle or the same drinking cup and stuff. And so I went on this, like, internet rabbit hole, like, being absolutely disgusted. And there was this huge public health push to, like, stop people from drinking out of this
banning
cup.
The public banning drinking the public cup drinking. I'm wow, I'm reading right now, holy shit. That's great.
Yeah.
Bring it back.
Yeah, no, Angela.
Bring back the bubbly drinking cup.
I think it was something I found out when the pandemic happened.
Yeah. Makes sense.
What are the things that we won't do anymore because we have been through the pandemic?
Oh my God, this is in New York too. A 1913 photo in Madison Square Park.
Ah, this little boy. Oh,
yeah, they just have a cup that was like chained to the well, and you're just like all everyone drinking on the same cup. It's like, oh man,
it's a great way to make sure everyone gets the same strain of cholera or typhus or whatever you like.
Yep.
Well, I think unless anyone else has anything else to say. I think we're.
This was a great conversation. Great movie. I really, really enjoyed it.
This is a great conversation about the movie. Yeah.
Well, then I guess we might be ready to roll. And listeners, if you're new to the show, we do things a little bit differently in terms of our ratings. We don't do 1 to 5. We don't do 1 to 10. We go all the way to 20, baby, in honor of the Dungeons & Dragons 20-sided die, where rolling a 20 is a critical hit and rolling a 1 is a critical failure. How will we roll on the Barefoot Contessa? I am going to start off with Corey. And the big question with Corey always is it going to be above 10 or below 10? Because anything below a 10 is just wasting Corey's time.
It's very true. 5. I got nothing else to say about it. 5.
Wizard, are you going to hit through the 10 barrier?
Yeah. You know, there's some good stuff here. There's some not great stuff here. I'll give it an 11.
Ooh!
Oh, wow. Okay.
I'm just pleased that I hit past the 10 barrier.
Yeah.
Peter, you're angry. This is going to be an angry roll.
When was the last time I got angry about a movie?
It's been a while.
And I was going to go 5, but Corey's just throwing 5 around like it's nothing, whereas I'm angry.
I'm angry too. Well,
this could be a 1 for you. I don't think, have you ever had a critical fail?
I was angry, but my first one. But my first emotion you know was just bored.
Yeah. Yeah, I wasn't, the anger snuck up on me. I'm just going to go 5. No, because this isn't a critical failure, because there is still like, those two moments of the dancing and the laughter are pretty fucking masterful. And I loved the lighting, loved the coloring, loved the like shooting on location. I think there's a lot to appreciate about this. And I do see why you connected with it, Angela. I'm so steamed over that style of storytelling and just the whole of the storytelling as it is, but also like what the storytelling is trying to do. All is disgusting. It's like upsetting to me. So 5.
Angela.
I'm gonna give it. Yeah, what do you mean? I'm ready to give this. I'm gonna buck the trends here because I think there was a lot more here. I like that that there were. It wasn't perfect. I'm going to accept this film as it is, and take from it what brings me joy. And I'm giving it a 16.
Hmm.
I liked it. Okay.
Into the green.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's a unique piece of cinema for the era. I find that in itself fascinating, even if it's flawed.
Those costumes were stunning.
They were.
Sorry.
No. Yeah. What I really want to know is, do you like this more than the other Barefoot Contessa?
Oh, I know. I tried so hard not to mention Ina Garten because she's so great. And it's almost a shame.
Sneak it in at the end.
You snuck it in there. I'm sort of confused why she named her store this.
Can I take a minute to do this?
Yeah, please, by all means.
So she bought like a bakery in 1975 that was named the Barefoot Contessa. It was like a cafe.
That was already named?
Like that. It was already named the Barefoot Contessa after the movie. And then she just took the Barefoot Contessa and ran with it as her brand. She, far as I know, has no meaningful connection to the movie whatsoever.
Huh.
Chan is Missing was the last time I got angry at a movie.
Wow. Really?
Sorry.
Wow.
Chan is Missing.
It's the voiceover, man. It's the voiceover. That'll do it.
I just really dislike the storytelling of Chan. Liz, I also want to shout out to listeners. You can keep track. I was able to find out that by looking at the spreadsheet of record that Crit Club has, which is in your show notes now.
Ooh. So, if you want, You can message us if you feel like it. If you've watched any of the movies we've seen, you have something to say, you have some feedback about how we do the show and that we never talk about anything Dungeons & Dragons related, except for the ratings.
We never will.
Maybe we never will. And I'm not going to apologize for it. Maybe you want to send a cookie recipe, chicken recipe, maybe some advice on gluten-free, dairy-free foods. Any of those things, you could email crickclubpodcast@gmail.com. You can visit us on our Instagram, which I am neglecting, apologies, at Crit Club Podcast on Instagram. We're also on Threads, but Crit Club Podcast, I'm not paying attention to it. If you want to get our attention, shoot us a message over the Gmail. There are no messages this week and no feedback, so no news there. But that pretty much wraps up our
news.
Our normal show.
No. We've got to talk about what we're going to watch next week.
Yeah.
That's right. So, who's up next week?
It is me.
Corey Pick.
So we're going to be watching the first Dogma 95 film, The Celebration, directed by no one, because rule number 10 of Dogma 95 is that the director must not be credited.
God. Oh my god!
I can tell you the next time I'm gonna get angry.
This is Protestant filmmaking, everybody. Do you like none of the strappings of cinema with your film?
Oh.
Welcome to Dogma 95.
It is directed.
Why make movies if you hate them so much? I don't get it.
It's just so funny to me that Corey is suggesting.
We're getting
this
in the way. Oh, I feel bad. Please, Corey, continue.
So, I'm surprised. I don't know. Like, there are some Dogma 95 films that I've seen that I do feel like I have liked. I don't have the list in front of me, though. But, it's directed by Thomas Vinterberg. And what is Dogma 95? Well, we'll talk all about it next week when we watch all about this strange little movement / dare that was sort of popular in the 90s and early 2000s. So we'll be watching The Celebration.
And we're getting out of the golden age of film.
Yeah.
It was nice to spend some time here, though. This was the last three have been in the golden age. This has been a lot of fun. To look at these old ones.
Well, we'll be looking forward to a new flavor of cinema next time. And so now we just get to talk about what else have we been watching.
It's true.
It's time. Okay, I guess we'll go with the same order. Corey, what you been watching?
Sure. So Frida and I have been watching The Curse, which is Nathan Fielder's sort of new thing.
I'm going to get to it.
Yeah. We haven't finished it, but it got me interested enough in. So it's co-created by Nathan Fielder and I'm going to blank on his name. Benny Safdie, I think is what it is.
Yeah, Safdie.
And so it got me interested in who Benny Safdie was. And I finally got around to watching one of the movies that he and I guess his brother. Uncut Gems, man.
Ooh, hell yeah. So did you watch it?
Oh, yeah. We watched it. It is so good.
Did you?
Such
it's,
a ride.
Yes.
It's
so I've been good. Trying. Such a ride. It's like. It's like one of the things that I've been certain that you would love for years.
Yes.
I think I've told you.
Yes, people have been. Yes. You were one of the people, and I've had other people tell me to watch it for so long. It's on a streaming service on Paramount, and I was just like, yeah, I'm gonna watch this. And Frida and I just both absolutely loved it. I mean, if you want to live a panic attack for two and a half hours, this movie.
That sounds like my worst nightmare.
It's so good.
I was so nervous about going into it because I was aware of that reputation, but instead it was like taking a dose of my Ritalin, and I was just like, no, I'm just on this ride now.
It is a
I'm
ride.
In this wavelength, and I'm just going.
Yeah, the whole movie is just an absolute ride, and I'm definitely going to be watching it again. It might be creeping up into one of my more favorite movies. It's really good.
I'm so glad you finally, I've been positive that this is a Corey movie. Yeah. There are a few things I know, but that is a Corey movie through and
absolutely.
Through and through.
If we were reviewing
bad
this,
people being terrible to themselves and others.
Yeah, if we were reviewing this on the show, it'd be an easy crit, 20,
yes.
For me. So, yeah.
I loved it. I love that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I'm
That's
so glad. That makes me so happy. That makes me so happy you saw it.
Wizard, what you watching?
What have I been up to? I want to give a big shout out to the novel Devil's Creek by Todd Kiesling, which I just finished. It's a real great read, a great horror novel about six people who grew up as children in a Lovecraftian cult, I guess, in Kentucky. And it's kind of got It vibes in the sense that the book picks up with them as they're like adults, like coming back to this small Kentucky town where a bunch of horrible shit happened to them. And it's super scary and it's a little gross, and it was a real fun ride, I gotta say. So Devil's Creek by Todd Kiesling. Check that out. I also, last week I saw Napoleon with my dad. Yeah. It's a dad movie. This is how I think a lot of people are seeing Napoleon. Not a good movie. Not a good movie. It's three different movies. It's one movie about this weird dude who is in love with this woman who's not all that into him, but she's nice enough and very successful, so she hangs out. Mm-hmm. It's also an epic, like, Napoleon film with, like, really well-done, like, battle scenes. And then it's a super boring movie where men in wigs, like, get around big wood tables and talk about the fate of Europe. And
I'm guessing that his French accent was impeccable.
Doesn't even bother. Doesn't even bother. Nobody does. It's British people pretending to be French. It's the next generation all over again. But the best of those three movies is the movie that's about this like weird dude who is obsessed with his own destiny and his relationship to this like fairly unconventional like woman who he is absolutely crazy about. And the scenes of this movie that are not Napoleon Bonaparte and Josephine like interacting together are totally uninteresting. Even the battles, I'm like, this is whatever. But there's a really interesting movie buried in this movie about these two people who have this like very weird relationship. And you know, it's based, I think, in part on like there's a bunch of letters that they wrote to each other that have survived where he's like, baby, I think you're amazing. And she's like, that's nice. And yeah, it wasn't super fun, but I really did enjoy this like weird, like almost like romantic, like mumblecore comedy that is part of Napoleon and probably the part people like the least about it. Anyways, I understand why it's unpopular in France. I don't understand why Ridley Scott has to be such a dick about people not liking his movies. It's not good.
He's old.
It's not good.
Is the reason is he is old.
Yeah, and I call on Ridley Scott to come and hash it out with us. If he wants to defend Napoleon to the people of Crick Club, bring it. God. Bring it on. And that's what I got. Old
man. Thank you, Wizard.
Boomer shit there.
Some boomer shit.
As someone who's argued with an older person for the better part of the last 10 years, I do not recommend it. there's not a lot of wind in it.
Can't convince them of anything.
Yeah. Peter, what you been watching?
Well, we had a long weekend, and I went to the theater twice and then watched a bunch of other movies beyond that. But the big one is I was scrambling to find this movie. I didn't know when it was releasing last year. I was like waiting for it through like August. I was like, when is this movie coming out? When is it coming out? And finally, it opened a little wider here in New York, and I was able to see Jonathan Glazer's The Zone of Interest.
Oh, yes. That's on my list, harrowing. Actually.
My expectations were sky high, and I was certain last year, like, this is going to be the best movie I see this year. And I watched it, and it surpassed those expectations. It was absolutely, okay. I mean, it was like, for those people who don't know, I didn't want to know anything going into it. I think the only thing I knew sort of was that it was taking place in the Holocaust. And so, you know, I guess I've loved Jonathan Glazer very deeply, and his movies are kind of masterpieces to me. And so I kind of didn't want to know as much as possible. So, but this is a movie about the commander who is in charge of Auschwitz, Rudolf Hess, who's a real person. And it's a very small movie about him and his family's life, home life, where they live just on the other side of the wall of Auschwitz. And it is just done in such, the movie is just constructed and done in such an abrasive way, but being a small domestic story that it is, but the reality of what is happening is never sort of, you don't escape it. And I think I was wondering throughout it, I was like, is this, it borders on a little heavy-handed, but it rides such a fine line, and it is just truly confrontational art in such a stunning way. I was incredibly stricken and affected by this movie. I thought it was brilliant because there are also, you know, some abstract touches throughout it, and the sound design is fucking next level, as it was on Under the Skin, his last movie. I don't know. Zone of Interest. And I've like wanted to read more nonfiction this year. So I that day I saw it, I started reading Hannah Arendt's Eichmann in Jerusalem. Which
is a good book.
I think a lot of what is talked about in that book you can see reflected on the screen in Zone of Interest. So I don't know. If you're a Jonathan Glazer fanboy like I am, this is another fucking masterpiece that I'm lucky to have seen before I died. What about you, Angela? What are you watching?
I went and saw Fahrenheit 451, like the 1960s version. Oh, nice. And it was quite entertaining. And considering how many times I had to read that book in high school, amazing how much I had forgotten from it. So it was kind of cool to just be able to watch it and relive it again. It's a little quaint because it was done in the 1960s and the salamander looks kind of goofy as fuck. And so it's kind of hard to relate to, but it's still very well done and worth watching. If it's ever available, you should watch it. It's a good movie. Didn't blow my mind or anything, but I enjoyed watching it. I liked the ending, of course. The ending was best. And I don't want to ruin it for you, but the visualization of how that ends was actually quite sweet.
I've not seen that edition or that...
It's the 1960s. Go see it or rent it, stream it, however you can do that. I'm also watching on Netflix From Scratch, which is kind of a travel romance starring Zoe Saldana, I think that's her name. I'm really enjoying that because it's I never see that kind of story centered among Black women, and I think it's beautiful and delightful and fun to watch on Netflix. Highly recommend it. I'm only like one or two episodes in. I don't know. I don't have a whole lot to say about it. My brain is a little fried from being stuck in snow for a whole week and a big project at work. But as always, I'm super happy to chat with you all.
Can I add one thing? Oh, I'm sorry.
I just want to add one thing really, really quick. Last week, the science fiction author Terry Bisson died. And he's really excellent writer. And I want to shout out on Crit Club officially the short story They're Made Out of Meat. It's a real short read. It's super, super fun. It's a really, really beautiful story, and that was just kind of a bummer.
He's from Kentucky.
That was just kind of a bummer. It's a great story. I just wanted to shout out that was a thing that people need to have in their lives.
I'm glad you said something. I will read that. I also wanted to add one more quick thing of what I've been watching, because I actually did watch a ton of movies this weekend, but I ended up watching finally The Creator. Movie that came out, the sci-fi movie about AI, I guess, that came out. And it was such, I felt like it was such a, the reason I wanted to bring it up here is because I thought it was such a fascinating watch to see it the same week we watched Thief of Baghdad, because The Creator is a bad movie. No one watched The Creator. Like, it is so god-awful stupid and doesn't know what it's even trying to want to begin to say. However, it is stunning. It is absolutely gloriously beautiful in its special effects and its design, in the, like, sci-fi design of everything. Like, I've saved it. I will watch it again specifically to look at the amazing design and the employment of its special effects. And so I think it has been great watching Thief of Bad Dad and all of those amazing special effects, and then going to watch The Creator, which I consider one of the best special effects movies, along with Dune, since in the past 5 years. So thank you. Just wanted to shout out. Don't watch The Creator. It's terrible. Aww. Unless you're a real fucking nerd about special effects and sci-fi design, in which case, yes, watch it, please.
Well, it sounds like that's our show, everybody. Thank you for listening and joining us. Next week, we will be listening and watching, what is it, Corey?
The Celebration.
Get ready. get ready, get some Lionel Richie there and celebrate, because we're watching the celebration.
It's not Scandinavian enough for the first Dogma 94, 95?
95.
Yeah,
the Kevin Smith movie.
The lost Kevin Smith movie.
Well, where can they reach out to us too? Yeah.
Yeah, reach out to us at critclubpodcast@gmail.com. And until then, we'll see you next week.
Thanks for this great movie, Angela. Thank you all for talking me through it.
Yeah. Thanks.
I'm going to take off my socks.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye.
Bye.